Security Administration said yesterday, that was back in 2006, that studies have concluded that plutonium used to trigger U.S. nuclear warheads and bombs will remain reliable for about 100 years, far longer than believed. That's from the Washington Post back in 2006.
Oh, I see. So they were considering I was reading the new material by Department of Defense, and also in 2000 when I was on Army base Rangers in the Columbus, Georgia, that was told again 12 years or maybe for other components of the warhead. Probably there's a time for, I don't know, renovation? How do you call it, Dr. Roy?
They just to remanufacture it, they process it, however you want to say. Yeah, you have your choice of either plutonium or uranium as the fuse for a fusion bomb. The hydrogen in a fusion bomb isn't going to decay anytime soon, so you're safe with that. It's just the trigger that decays over time, and with plutonium, it's as much as 100 years. I don't know exactly uranium-235, how long it becomes a viable trigger, but again, I assume it's a lot more than 12 years. I don't think anyone's particularly worried about our bombs going bad over the short haul.
They're never going to be using it. Koreans are crazy.
Problem is that if you play chicken with sane people, usually nothing terrible happens. If you play chicken with a crazy person, the crazy person wins. If you play chicken with two crazy people, no one wins.
Busy today, but I did catch the news at one point talking about scaring the wits out of Hawaii, you know. So you don't even have to, you know, have any active nukes going in the air. You know, what if anybody tripped, fall, broke their leg, you know, just got damaged or hurt themselves running around in Hawaii, you know. Just talking about this stuff is bad news.
Mistakes happen and false alerts happen, and I vaguely recall at some point where a computerized system that detects early launch erroneously detected a launch from the Soviet Union many, many years ago. And fortunately, before we did anything about it, we realized that it was just a computer error. But we have been living in dangerous times for at least the last 50, 60 years, and I don't see it changing much in the future.
Yeah, I grew up with it, with a Cuban crisis, you know, as a kid. And they had duck and cover, you know. And then everybody seemed to forget about it, you know. There's no more of that. No more bomb shelters. Not that I know of, anyway. And but meanwhile, the danger is still there, and that's not good, you know. So, like you said, I hope they never use this stuff. Okay, I don't have any other questions or comments or for anybody. Roy, do you have anything else? HC2GSWS1.
AC2GS, I always got something somewhere. I never believed in duck and cover. In Brooklyn, they sort of stopped duck and cover just as I guess I got into elementary school, because I have no memory of it whatsoever. But from that point on, I've always told people, in case of a nuclear holocaust, bend over and kiss your backside goodbye. Because I don't care what hole you've dug in the ground, especially in this area, the first missiles go to Manhattan, and we're damn close to Manhattan, so lots of luck with the bomb shelters.
I agree. And then you have to worry about the nuclear winter. We're in a car, but I think if you had enough nukes to go off, you could wind up with that too. So even if you come out of your bomb shelter, wait for the radiation to die down a little bit. I don't know how many years that would take. You have to worry about the nuclear winter when nothing grows. And when you run out of your canned food, it's over.
AC2GS, I think guys living in the Amazon might be worried about nuclear winter. If people who live very close to Wall Street will probably be reduced to ash within microseconds. So, you know, like I said before, it's an unacceptable risk. And so people just decided to not think about it, you know, the way we think about all unacceptable risks.
Yeah, I can try. I think what's the only thing that's kept everything going is the MAD, let's call it MAD, mutual destruction. You know, agreements between a couple of somewhat sane countries that had all this nukes. But then you get a couple of rogue nations in there, that could be a problem. And I probably, must be the nations now that have that capability. And you just don't want to have it get into the wrong hands. You know, somebody looking for the end of the world or something. So that's your biggest problem now. You don't have to worry about the people that believe in MAD. You have to worry about the people that are looking to end everything. So I'll have to come up with a new acronym for that. ACUGSWS.
That's the inherent flaw in mutually assured destruction. You're playing a game of chicken, and like I said before, as long as all the players are sane, you're kind of safe, hopefully. But you introduce more and more crazy people to the mix, and a game of chicken can be very disastrous. So that's the problem. As time goes on, more and more countries will be picking up this technology, and eventually we will come upon someone who, you know, in the famous words, wants to see it all burn.
I have a sarcastic comment.
That's what,
Yeah, well, you just said more and more countries will pick up the technology. Think about the technology as something that could be picked up. We just finished fight with cigarettes and a fight with alcohol. And we have in Pennsylvania the biggest crisis of opioids. So sooner or later, all of the states will pick up that as a law. That means it will be allowed. So if we think about that, let me jump
to that problem. He wasn't worried that, you know, as much about developing the technology asteroid. He was worried more about, you know, some rogue nation going out there and moving the asteroid in the direction of Earth to end it all. He worried more about that scenario than the asteroid actually coming and hitting us.
I mean, I have a line that I use over and over again about tools that we develop and design, that they're neither inherently evil or inherently good. A hammer can build you a house. A hammer can cave in your skull. The same with any other technology. And unfortunately, as we develop more and more technology, there will be people who turn it around and use it to destroy. And that's what worries me a great deal. As time goes on, there'll be more and more of these technologies. And eventually, they'll find their way to some guy who builds something in his garage that goes boom.
I concur. One of the guys out there has a question, comment, put in that. This is WS2N.
Well, actually, Paul, you were doubling with Wesley. Wesley was making some comment that he thought that inevitably more and more things will be legalized. I tend to disagree with you, Wesley. The opioid epidemic is scaring a lot of people and killing a lot of people, and they've been locking the stuff down to a degree, and I don't see a change in that trend over time. They might allow for the use of medicinal marijuana and not quite medicinal marijuana, but I wouldn't hold my breath to wait for opiates to be unrestricted. They will become even more and more restricted. I mean, I, as a physician, have all kinds of safeguards that I have to maneuver around just to write a prescription for a week's supply for some people. So it is tightening up. It's not loosening.
Now, my question is from trying to approach from the other side. Why did we fight with cigarettes and with alcohol? Are we allowing opiates?
Because opiates have a clinical value. They are a pain reduction medicine. If a person is dying from cancer, unfortunately, and their life is a living misery, and you can knock some of the pain away with the chance of them becoming an addict 3 minutes before they die, then that's a plus. So there are purposes for opiates that are beneficial. There's no purpose for cigarettes that are beneficial unless you own a cigarette company. They have given so many of my patients lung cancer, emphysema, bronchitis, heart disease, and it goes on and on and on. There's a reason why they're called coffin nails. And, you know, alcohol, if you're so inclined, so be it, but all things in moderation. But the problem is society as a whole has to pay part of the bill of what individual people do to kill themselves.
Oh, so that is why they introduced recreational marijuana, and soon there would be so many recreational drugs, in order for those people to pay the bill for production of non-recreational but medical opioids for people who are in need of it. Is that true?
Not at all. Opiates are relatively simple to manufacture. The uncontrolled price for those products would amaze people. You know, and the black market, you know, you can pay a $10 for a pill. But in pharmacies up until, say, 5 years ago, the same pill would probably cost about 20 cents. They're very simple. They're based on poppy plants. They grow a lot of them in places like Afghanistan, and they're readily available. So, no, you don't have to subsidize manufacture of opiates. They're really dirt cheap, unfortunately.
So, you agree with me that recreational drugs that are allowed in many states right now are business for the states, not help for the sick and ill and trivial.
What can I tell you, Wesley? Government has always made Faustian agreements, you know, with the devil. A lot of states allow gambling, which can destroy people's lives. They could ruin them. They could lose their house. And yet, for the sake of education, although the money just goes into the general budget, they approve lotteries and other gambling. So we allow certain types of detrimental activity because people want to do it. If you don't let them do anything, they get angrier. So you have to find some happy medium, and the governments always make money off of anything. If they could put something on your nostril to measure the amount of air you breathe, you would have one.
Well, the point is that if you are a gambler and this is your addiction, if you don't have money, you just become somebody who is going to be supported by the government. But if you use recreational drug and you become dependent, you're not only being taken care of by the government, but also they have to pay your medical bills. So that's the difference.
Okay, but I mean, degenerate gamblers don't simply retire into welfare. They wreck families, they wreck children, they wreck wives, they wreck brothers and sisters. There are wrecking crew around them, so they manifest a lot of damage. It's not medical damage directly, but it's a lot of other forms of damage. So six of one, half a dozen of the other.
So what is your position in there?
My position is that we are flawed creatures, that we have great assets and great liabilities, and we all have to make some kind of mutual agreement with each other of what we will tolerate and what we can't. And the bottom line to me is do no damage to anyone else. If you must do damage to yourself, it's problematic, but certainly don't ask someone else to go along for the ride. That's the best I can come up with. You saw what happened when Prohibition was tried. It had a lofty concept. It made a lot of sense on a very intellectual level, and it was ruinous for everything and everyone. So the best plans of mice and men do often go awry.
Christian, yeah, you got me there. Prohibition didn't work, and there is not much problem. And we're talking about 100% of humanity versus a small percentage of the people they are dependent on the alcohol. But I believe drugs are more dangerous than alcohol. And drugs
can be. They don't have to be. Studies have shown that marijuana, that stays marijuana use, is less dangerous, generally speaking, than chronic alcohol users and chronic smokers. So it depends on your study and depends on your predilection. There are soft drugs, there are hard drugs, there are poisons, and they mix, they match, and they shift with our times, unfortunately. You know, opiates have gotten far worse than they ever got before. There's this wonderful stuff, and I'm being very sarcastic, called fentanyl, which I think is one of the main reasons why people like Michael Jackson died. That stuff is like heroin times 100. So they're making even stronger stuff these days. It's a wonder that you know, the vapors of this stuff doesn't induce euphoria in us all.
I think I finished my questioning. Anybody has a question?
Well, I have a question for you, Paul. You mentioned Andy Weir's Artemis. Did you like the book, dislike the book? What was your opinion of the book?
Yeah, I liked the book. I think the Martian book was better. But Artemis is... I like the concept of a city on, well, a small town on the moon. I think at that time they had that little bit of a city on the moon. They would have had they didn't talk about the equipment, the rockets that you would need. Go back and forth to the Earth. I would have liked to seen that. I would have liked to seen some kind of a spaceport, where, you know, showing that these, you know, how this guy thinks these things would be landing and how far from the town it would be and the transportation for it. could have been a few other things I would have liked to see. I don't see how you can make it a movie, although Hollywood is very good with the special effects. Everything that takes place in that book, everything would be, you know, in 6G, you know, 1/6 the gravity. They talk about that moon, you know, and the book about, you know, being on the moon and everything that occurs and the problems with 1/6 G and the benefits of it. But how they could actually create a movie out of this, I don't know. Well, Hollywood's pretty good, maybe they. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, I think James Cameron could. I mean, he made Avatar, and apparently he's going to make 115 more Avatars. So when he gets finished with all his 115 Avatars, I don't think it would be too much of a problem for him. I found it a little bit too generic. It was, as you mentioned, it was not very technical. It was basically a heist movie done in the backdrop of a moon colony.
Yeah, I agree. You know, he tried to get in. You know, his technical ability, when he was working, he was involved with things breaking and, you know, spacewalk type of equipment, and he spent a lot of time on that, a lot of detail on that. Hollywood would change that. They would find different ways to hype it up. Spent a lot of time on that type of detail, you know, how to operate a torch, you know, in a vacuum, on and on. You know, which was interesting to me because I spent my life with oxygen torches and what, of course. So, you know, naturally I enjoy that, but I don't think that would work in a film. And because they stayed on that, you know the whole thing was in that Artemis. They never went down to Earth, never talked to the person that she was talking to down, you know, never met them in person. They could have done a few other things, and they might take that dramatic license and change that in a movie.
Yeah, they could always change stuff. I mean, there's a movie I'm looking forward to. It's called Ready Player One. Which is basically about a virtual reality game where the guy who owned it all and was worth billions of dollars hid all of his money inside the game, and the person who solves all the clues, you know, wins billions and billions of dollars in this post-apocalyptic world that everything is rusting and falling apart. And it uses a lot of the 1980s as a touchstone. And I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, what I decided to do after I read Artemis was to reread a very, very old book that I loved. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Robert Heinlein wrote that in the 50s, and it's still up to date. He has a nice little entry about catapults that throw their projectiles back into the Earth orbit.
Actual catapults, spring-loaded or something. I mean, they have maglev catapult-type systems that, you know, are being developed. Eventually, you could probably use on the moon. There was one movie that came out, and it was called Moon. That was the name of it, and it was okay, you know. But the one thing that they did stress was point out that they had the maglev type of thing, which would shoot the, I think it was truck, you know, the rare material they were mining on the moon, and it off things, and that's how it started to orbit, and they bring it back. But that's what they had. They didn't have actual catapults, but they had live maglev catapults. What did they use in that 1950 book?
Heinlein was never a big technical guy. He wasn't quite like Isaac Asimov, liked to explain why everything worked in his science fiction. Robert Heinlein was much more interested in human interactions, and if he had a choice of it being technically correct or that it's working to demonstrate a quirk in humanity, he would go with the quirk every day. I mean, this is the guy who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, which was very quirky. I don't know. I love every one of his books, as weird as he got in old age. He was writing them, I think, until the end, stranger and stranger. But Asimov was the guy who would describe everything in minute detail so that you could almost go back to the lab and build his future. He was a smart guy.
I liked Asimov. But, getting back to Autumn, I wouldn't recommend it for a young kid. I don't like any books that have a lot of cursing in it. I don't know what the point is. I don't get that. But you're taking away viewership, in my opinion. So, I'm not going to give it an 8. But interesting. And I would like to see somebody come out with a... It would have to make quite a few changes, But this whole idea of, like, classically a non... law enforced type society that they would be on the moon 100 years from now. I don't think that would work out. If we go to the moon or to an asteroid or something like that, whatever country you come from, you be governed by the laws and regulations. Not going to get serious and make up rules and regulations, I don't think. That's the way it went when the new world was discovered. I don't think that would happen in the future. It's sort of like whatever boat, whatever ship bought, you're going to go to out in the middle of the sea, you're governed by whatever flick you want. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS.
AC2GS. It depends on the people you're shipping to the colony. If it's Botany Bay, then you're not going to get guys that follow the rule that much. If you get it all from NASA, yes. They'll brush their teeth in unison. So ultimately, it's the population pool that you convince to drop everything and move to a planetoid. And I think part of Artemis was the sense that these were people who were risky people. They had nothing to lose in the old country, and so they didn't strike me as the type of people who would follow every rule imaginable, but more guys that would figure out how to game the system.
Yeah. I don't know, 100 years from now, they made it seem like, people were going to be coming up to the moon that, they weren't even sure who they were when they were coming and going. I think even 100 years from now, I think that would be, they'd pretty much be pretty sure who was going and coming, but maybe not. I think if you had... city after city on the moon for, 100 years from now. I think that would be the case, but in this case, it's only the one town. That's it. I think everything would be checked and double-checked before they sent it to the moon. Talk about the contraband and everything. I don't know. Good book. Hopefully he makes another book that I might like better. Back to you, Ron.
Well, this book seems to be successful, so I am sure he will write yet another book. That's the beauty of most authors, with the exception of very few. If you give them a payday, they'll go and make another one for you. I've seen some books, series degenerate into drivel over years due to that unfortunate effect. With some of the books that I love the most in science fiction, was the Dune book. And Dune, I don't know if you read it, I find it a great book. I'll reread it once every 10, 15 years. As the next book came, one after the other, it got kind of spacier and spacier, and I don't know if it was just Frank Herbert getting very ill and close to death, or whether he just didn't give a damn and wanted to cash another check. So, writers will write, especially if we pay them. If you feed a cat, the cat will come back. If you pay an author, they'll give you another book.
Oh, very good. Well, some books, like Dune, is good, but it was the movie I was crazy about. Now, the other way around for the 2001 Space Odyssey, I saw the movie, and then eventually the book was developed and came out after the movie was made. And then when I read the book, you know, that was like a roadmap to the movie, you know, trying to basically explain what they didn't explain in that movie. You know, it was over 2 hours of movie, probably 2.5 hours of movie or more. And out of that, you know, there was only 40 minutes of dialogue. So to come up with a book afterwards, fix that. But then they keep writing other movies afterwards. You know, they came out with 2010 Space Odyssey, and for the other one, 37, I think. You know, it's just never as good as the first one. It's very hard for me to find second movies or second books that beat the first one.
No, I really like Terminator 2. I happen to have loved Terminator 1 as well. And as far as remakes, I don't know if you ever saw the original The Fly, but the remake of The Fly was about 10 trillion times better.
Give me Vincent Price in that group any day. I thought a remake, but I'll go with the original. Now, certain sci-fi movies, The Forbidden Planet, now that was a landmark film ahead of its time, just like when 2001 Space Odyssey came out. That laid the groundwork for future space type of movies. But Forbidden Planet was, you know, terrific. And back then when you watched it, that was way out there. Even today, you know, if you watched it, it's still a very good movie.
Forbidden Planet was another big one. I love Forbidden Planet. Forbidden Planet came out in the 1950s, whereas 2001 came out in the 1960s. And I still, in this shack, I have a coin-operated Robbie the Robot bank. He doesn't generate bottles of space hooch, but he can store my quarters and nickels.
Ah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I think Space Odyssey came out probably 1960. I think I saw it late 1967, maybe early 1968. When it first came out, I saw it in the city, and I watched it on a great screen. Yep, this whole world. You were staring at this thing for hours. Going back to what we were talking about in the earlier part of it, you get used to seeing something, you know. Walk out and then to the streets at the end of the movie and look around at the skyscrapers and everything. I don't know, it just looked like I went back in time. That's when I left that movie.
I don't know. I was kind of confused by 2001. I mean, I was one of the guys that had to read novelization to figure out what the heck I just saw. Sometimes I like that, but sometimes it's too much work for something that I'm paying for. You know, if I wasn't paying for it, then I'll put in the extra work. But hell, I'm paying my ticket price. Tell me exactly what the end really means.
Yeah. The meaning of it is still questionable after got a pause, you know, these, yeah, last couple of words in the movie, that didn't happen. But in the book, they describe the dimensions of the monolith. It was the, the cube of each, first three numbers of 1, 2, and 3. You know, so one side was, well, the proportion was 1, and then the other side, length. So, it was supposed to mean something. But at least in the book, you read that in the movie. They don't describe that.
Yeah, it kind of got a little flaky. I mean, that was the problem that I had with Dune. I mean, Dune, unfortunately, was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who did what he did to King Kong as well, and directed by David Lynch, who's a little weird to begin with, so I wasn't surprised that Dune was rather weird. I think they're going to try it once again. They've made it into a movie, they've made it into a TV miniseries, and I keep hearing rumors that they're going to try movie again. So they're going to keep trying to do it until they get it right, and probably a few more times even after that.
Okay, very good. Okay, I don't have any other comments. And, by the way, it doesn't help me see things in 3D. I don't think 3D. I have a bit of amateur myself, so, you know, everybody wants to see these 3D movies. I couldn't care less. Yeah, I can see it, but, you know, you really need good vision in both eyes to make that worthwhile. So anytime these movies do come out, I go see them. Like last one, I don't go that often. So the movie Passages, I'm not going to go see that in 3D. Just see it in regular 2D. Back to you.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point that probably if it's not directed by James Cameron, I'm not going to watch it in 3D because it's going to be a disappointment. I've seen some of Cameron's 3D work, and the guy must be a pain in the backside to work for, but he certainly is an obsessive compulsive perfectionist, which is nice as long as you're not working for one.
Oh, very good. And you saw the movie that he made, spent years on that, and that was, what's the name of the movie? You just said it 10 minutes ago. You know, All With All the Blue People. You saw that in 3D?
Yeah, Avatar, which is really Dances with Wolves. He's not really a big guy for plots. He's more for the whole package type of thing. I mean, there wasn't anything really novel in Avatar, but it was a beautiful film.
Yeah, he's pretty good. And he does some risky things himself. He just went to the bottom of the, I think he went to the Mariana Trench, some kind of a submersible. I guess he had somebody else with him. Probably two of them went down there. He does a lot of weird, he does weird things like that.
Hey, he's a driven guy. Driven guys do driven things. Sometimes it's to our amusement. Sometimes it's purely to his own amusement. He's obviously got a thing about that boat, and he spent a lot of time and money, and the heck of it, I forget how much that film got him. Is it $1 billion, $1.5 billion? I think it's something like the second grossing or the third grossing film in history, and I think the second or the first one is Avatar. So you want to bet on anyone, bet on James Cameron. He's actually, I understand that he's going to try another Terminator film, which I would love to see him do, because the Terminators that were made after he left the franchise were really rotten things.
Oh, okay. He's going to make a comeback? All right. Well, We'll see that when it comes out. Very good. I wonder if anybody's left out there that has any comments or questions. Clock ticks down here. This is WS2.
And this is AC2GS. Anyone out there with any comments, questions for the technical net? As long as we made it all the way to 11:47, I figure we should make it to midnight. So please, if you don't bring up a subject, you know I will.
Well, half the group with the Selman machine net in. Not connected all night, but we did okay.
Yeah, a bunch of things fell apart. The Echo Link has been off for about 99% of our time. So I don't know exactly what's caused that. I'm sure Eric knows exactly what's causing that. So, yeah, we were handicapped, but despite it, you know, the not ready for primetime players put on a good show.
Yeah, with Selman down, I think that's where we're at. Canada comes through on that. Well, Sal, a few other people. They can't get into that. I think they're dead in the water.
We are being heard from other people farther away in Canada. There's a gentleman in our chat room, V3JIW. I assume he's getting there via the W2LIE streaming live net. So, where there's a will, I guess there's a way.
All right. Let's see what he wants. Okay. Anybody out there, questions? About anything technical or any comments? This is WS1.
I think we've tired the poor people out tonight.
On a Pegasus called the Icon. Icon is going to look at the ionosphere and concentrate on that. One of the things they want to investigate is how it affects radio communication. It's going to look for other things as well, but that's the part I'm interested in. So it's going to be launched from the L-1011 jumbo jet that Orbital Science has, and it's going to fly out of, the plane itself is going to fly out of the Kwajalein Islands down by the Marshall Islands near the equator. So this way he gets a little extra zoom from anything near the equator. So it'll take off on a jumbo jet, be dropped from that, and then take off to go to outer space. They've done about 40 or 50 of these type of missions over the years. They don't do them that often, but I'll be looking for that. That will be a NASA mission, and that will be on NASA TV. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, it's always good when they do further propagation studies because it helps people figure out what the heck is going on because all kinds of fun stuff happens with propagation. This morning I have a 10-meter net. A bunch of us get together and wake up 10 meters from its slumber, and we were talking about the solar sunspot cycles and how there are doom and gloom sayers out there that are suggesting that we may have reached a strange point where we're not sticking to a basic 11-year cycle, and the next 11-year cycle is going to be not as strong as it once was. So everyone's kind of turning pessimistic about our sunspot cycles, which is understandable because propagation, I don't know about anyone out there, but anyone out there who likes to work 10 and even sometimes 20, not to mention 6 meters, is there's nothing going on. It's all kind of dead. Every so often, there's a little sporadic E to wake you up, but otherwise, nothing.
Yeah, okay. Well, the ICON mission, and it's going to be teamed up with another mission called Global Scale Observations of the Limb and the Disc, and that's going to be at a very high altitude. And then the ICON will be low. And they're going to do a lot of evaluations of this. And they want to see how the Earth weather going up to the 50-mile area affects the ionosphere, as well as the space weather, you know, all the protons and electrons and everything that hit the ionosphere from above, and, you know, which ones are in conjunction with both affects the ionosphere and change the different layers and communication. You can worry about these things because of both positioning satellites and everything else. Affects the ham, you know. But yeah, sometimes the exhibition is still open. It'll work 80 meters. I don't know about somebody up 20. It's not working too good on 20. I'm either on 40 or 80.
Yeah, 80 meters is good from dusk until dawn. 40 is kind of the go-to band lately that I've seen. 20, lots of luck with 20, and it just gets worse as you get higher. But have you heard about the Consumer Electronics Show that was last week in Las Vegas?
I missed that altogether. No, I didn't. I know in Las Vegas they do that. I haven't heard anything about it this year.
Okay, I found the go-to gift to give the person in your life that's worried about radio waves affecting them and already is walking around with an aluminum foil hat. It's called the Spartan. It's the underwear that protects your manhood. It's a Faraday cage for boxer shorts.
What's going to become real? Sounds like a terrible idea. So, based on that, invested in it. I don't know how many times I see these crazy things that come out. Next thing I know is everybody has one.
I don't think this particular item is going to really take off. It's on Kickstarter if you want to invest, but I wouldn't recommend it. But it's probably very suitable for, like I said before, guys who already are fitted with a tinfoil hat to keep those mind control waves out of their heads.
Okay. Dick will like this product, you know, because of all the cell phone topics he's always talking about. You know, people carry cell phones on their belts. And then they have the Bluetooth attached to their ears. But, you know, I'm sure that's a real powerful signal that's gonna ruin everybody. But that'll be a big seller. In fact, they should sell it with every cell phone.
Actually, the ARRL newsletter a couple of weeks ago had a kind of, I checked my calendar to make sure it wasn't April 1st. They had an article in the newsletter that an amateur radio operator had tested the 900 megahertz RF on mice and thought that they had cognitive improvement. So he's going to market this thing, I guess, that looks like a shower cap with electrodes that have small antennas that emit a small amount of 900 megahertz RF. And the concept is that if you expose yourself to this RF, you will slow the onset of senility. So how do you like that one?
I guess, know, I have a transmitter here. It works on two little AA batteries. And it transmits on 900 megahertz. And you know what it is? All it is the transmitter for the temperature outside. I have this thing screwed to a fence post, probably about, I don't know, 150 feet away from me right now. And then my receiver is in the shack, and that receives the signal. And it's really reliable. I mean, I change the batteries every, you know, right before the winter. But the batteries could probably last every 2 years. But what a good thing. Works great. So I'm probably getting blasted by, you know, microwatts of 902 every 4 seconds it transmits. It's probably frying my brain, I think. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I have something called Lacrosse Alert. I don't even, unfortunately, know what frequency it works on, but it also has multiple sensors in different rooms in the house and outside, and it tells me the humidity and the temperature. It's I wish I could kind of hook it up to other programs and have it do a little bit more. It's just a web browsing site, so you can't really plug it in with any kind of extension, but it's nice to at least know the information. I mean, sometimes it's kind of 20/20 hindsight. Last Sunday, as I was on this very TechNet, my basement flooded, and I went back to the recording, and I saw down in the basement the water level on the water indicator went from 0 to 100% in about, I don't know, about 10 minutes or something, and so I saw my flood in beautiful graphic form.
Wow, that's terrible news. But this one is by cross, so my guess is probably the same thing. I think it's transmitting around 930 megahertz. It's in a, it's really within, just outside the ham band. That's what it is, and it sends the temperature, the outside temperature. But indoors, you know, it gives you the indoor temperature, gives you the indoor humidity. It picks up the Fort Collins transmission in Colorado, so it gives you the time and all of that. Maybe you have something the same with, but it's also by Lacrosse. This is Lacrosse technology.
Very good. I don't think I have anything that communicates with Colorado. It's plugged into the internet anyway, so anything that it needs to grab, it can grab from the internet. My house is a small Faraday cage in many ways. I have these clocks that are supposed to calibrate with Colorado, and usually they never connect even in the middle of the night. There's just too much chicken wire and plaster that's in the walls. It blocks all those RF.
Oh, yeah, I get that. Okay. Very good. Looking at the time, 12:01. So it's been fun. Good net, and we'll make it back here next week. Dick will be back here to RIW. And back over to you, Roy, before the machine says goodbye.
Okie doke, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra with the Limark Technical Net, whatever number it might be, because I never remember the numbers, unfortunately. I want to thank Paul for his help. I want to thank Wesley. I want to thank all the people that participated tonight and let me play little mind games and what have you, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope if you think of something that you would like me to expand upon, you send the email to tech@limarktech.net. So thanks, everyone, for the opportunity. Next week, Dick will be back, and I'll just be jabbering about science. So 73 to all of you. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you all down the log.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being on the technet and letting me to ask the questions and for my conclusion and to exchange.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the WQVL repeater. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, WQVL repeater system.